Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of the Confessions of St. Augustine. Volume 10, Book 10, 30. It is truly your command that I should be continent and restrain myself from gratification of corrupt nature, gratification of the eye, the empty pomp of living. You commanded me not to commit fornication, and though you did not forbid me to marry, you counseled me to take a better course. You gave me the grace, and I did your bidding, even before I became a minister of your sacrament. But in my memory, of which I have said much, the images of things imprinted upon it by my former habits still linger. When I am awake, they obtrude themselves upon me, though with little strength. When I dream, they not only give me pleasure, but are very much like acquiescence in the act. The power which these illusory images have over my soul and my body is so great that what is no more than a vision can influence me in sleep in a way that the reality cannot do when I am awake. Surely it cannot be that when I am asleep, I am not myself, O Lord my God. And yet the moment when I pass from wakefulness to sleep, or return again from sleep to wakefulness, marks a great difference in me. During sleep, where is my reason which, when I am awake, resists such suggestions and remains firm and undismayed, even in the face of the realities themselves? Is it sealed off when I close my eyes? Does it fall asleep with the senses of the body? And why is it that even in sleep I often resist the attractions of these images? For I remember my chaste resolutions, and abide by them, and give no consent to temptations of this sort. Yet the difference between waking and sleeping is so great that even when during sleep it happens otherwise, I return to a clear conscience when I wake and realize that because of this difference I was not responsible for the act, although I am sorry that by some means or other it happened to me. The power of your hand, O God Almighty, is indeed great enough to cure all the diseases of my soul. By granting me more abundant grace, you can even quench the fire of sensuality that provokes me in my sleep. More and more, O Lord, you will increase your gifts in me, so that my soul may follow me to you, freed from the concupiscence that binds it, and rebel no more against itself. By your grace, it will no longer commit in sleep these shameful, unclean acts inspired by sensual images that lead to the pollution of the body. It will not so much as consent to them. For to you, the Almighty, who are powerful enough to carry out your purpose beyond all our hopes and dreams, it is no great task to prescribe that no temptations of this kind, even such slight temptations as can be checked by the least act of will, should arouse pleasure in me, even in sleep, provided that my dispositions are chaste. This you can do for me at any time of life, even in the prime of manhood. But now I make this confession to my good Lord, declaring how I am troubled by this kind of evil. With awe in my heart I rejoice in your gifts, yet I grieve for my deficiencies, trusting that you will perfect your mercies in me until I reach the fullness of peace that I shall enjoy with you in soul and body when death is swallowed up in victory. 31. There is another evil that we meet with day by day, if only it were the only one, for we repair the daily wastage of our bodies by eating and drinking, until the time comes when you will bring both food and our animal natures to an end. When that time comes, your wonderful fullness will spell the end of our need, and you will clothe this corruptible nature of ours with incorruptible life. But for the present I find pleasure in this need, though I fight against it, for fear of becoming its captive. Every day I wage war upon it by fasting. Time and again I force my body to obey me. But the pain that this causes me is cancelled by the pleasure of eating and drinking, for of course hunger and thirst are painful. Like a fever, they parch and kill unless they are relieved by the remedies of food and drink. And since to console us we have your gifts, for you have given us earth and water and sky to serve us in our weakness, the remedies are there for us to find, and we think of this hardship as a source of delight. Because you have taught me to understand this, I look upon food as medicine. But the snare of concupiscence awaits me in the very process of passing from the discomfort of hunger to the contentment that comes when it is satisfied. For the process itself is a pleasure, and there is no other means of satisfying hunger except the one that we are obliged to take. And although the purpose of eating and drinking is to preserve health, in its train there follows an ominous kind of enjoyment that often tries to outstrip it. So it is really for the sake of pleasure that I do what I claim to do and mean to do for the sake of my health. Moreover, health and enjoyment have not the same requirements, for what is sufficient for health is not enough for enjoyment, and it's often hard to tell whether the body, which must be cared for, requires further nourishment, or whether we are being deceived by the allures of greed demanding to be gratified. My unhappy soul welcomes this uncertainty, using it to vindicate and excuse itself. It is glad that the proper requirements of health are in doubt, so that under the pretense of caring for health, it may disguise the pursuit of pleasure. Every day I try my hardest to resist these temptations. I call for your helping hand and tell you of my difficulties, because this is a problem which I have not yet resolved. I hear the voice of my God who commands us, "Do not let your hearts grow dull with revelry and drunkenness." Drunkenness is far from me. By your grace, may you prevent it from coming near. But there have been times when overeating has stolen upon your servant. By your mercy, may you keep it far from me, for no man can be master of himself, except of God's bounty. You grant us many gifts when we pray for them, and even before we pray for them, all the good things that we have ever received have come from you, that we should later recognize that they came from you as also a gift. I have never been a drunkard myself, but I have known drunkards made sober by you. Therefore, just as it is by your doing that men who were once drunkards are not forever, it is also by your doing that those who were never drunkards are not drunkards now. And in the same way, it is also by your doing that men of both sorts know that it is you who did this for them. I have also heard these words of yours: "Do not follow the counsel of appetite. Turn your back on your own liking." By your gift I have also heard and found great comfort in the words: "We gain nothing by eating, lose nothing by abstaining." This means that eating will not bring me plenty, nor abstinence reduce me to misery. I have heard these words too: "I have learned to be content with my circumstances as they are. I know what it is to have abundant means, and what it is to live in want. Nothing is beyond my powers, thanks to the strength God gives me." Here speaks a true soldier of the heavenly army, not mere dust like the rest of us. "But remember, O Lord, that we are dust. Remember that you made man from dust, and that he was lost and found again." My heart goes out to Paul for the words he wrote by your inspiration: "Nothing is beyond my powers, thanks to the strength God gives me." But he too was dust and could not do all things by his own power. Give me strength, O Lord, so that I may do all things. Give me the grace to do as you command, and command me to do what you will. Paul acknowledges your gifts, and the boast that he makes is made in the Lord. I have also heard another of your servants begging for your gifts in these words: "Let the itch of gluttony pass me by." All this makes it clear, O holy God, that when your commands are obeyed, it is from you that we receive the power to obey them. Good Father, you have taught me that nothing can be unclean for those who have clean hearts, yet it goes ill with the man who eats to the hurt of his own conscience. You have taught me that all is good that God has made. Nothing is to be rejected. Only we must be thankful to him when we partake of it, and that it is not what we eat that gives us our standing in God's sight. That no one must be allowed to take us to task over what we eat or drink, and that no man over his meat should mock at him who does not eat it, nor while he abstains pass judgment on him who does eat it. For these lessons which I have learnt, all praise and all thanks be to you, my God, my Master, to you who knock at the door of my ears and shed your light over my heart. Deliver me from all temptation. It is the uncleanness of gluttony that I fear, not unclean meat. For I know that Noah, was allowed to eat all kinds of meat that were suitable as food, that Elias was fed on meat, and that John the Baptist, remarkable ascetic that he was not polluted by the flesh of living creatures, the locusts which were granted to him as food. On the other hand, I know that Esau was defrauded by his greed for a dish of lentils, that David reproached himself for longing for a drink of water, and that Christ our King was tempted not by meat, but by bread. And the Israelites in the desert deserved rebuke, not because they wanted meat, but because in their greed for food they sulked and grumbled against the Lord. In the midst of these temptations, I struggled daily against greed for food and drink. This is not an evil that I can decide once and for all to repudiate and never to embrace again, as I was able to do in the case of fornication. I must therefore hold back my appetite with neither too firm nor too slack a rein. But is there anyone, O Lord, who is never enticed a little beyond the strict limit of need? If there is such a one, he is a great man. Let him praise your name. But I am not such a man. I am a poor sinner. Yet I too praise your name, and Christ, who conquered the world, pleads with you for my sins. He numbers me among the weak members of his body. For your eyes looked upon me when I was yet unformed. All human lives are already written in your record. 32. The sense of smell does not trouble me greatly with its attractions. I do not miss sweet scents when they are absent, but neither do I refuse them when I find them. I am even ready to do without them altogether. This, at least, is my own opinion of myself, but I may be wrong, for the powers of my inner self are veiled in darkness that I must deplore. When my mind speculates upon its own capabilities, it realizes it cannot safely trust its own judgment, because its inner workings are generally so obscure that they are only revealed in the light of experience. And besides this, during this life that may be called a perpetual trial, no one should be confident that although he has been able to pass from a worse state to a better, he may not also pass from a better state to a worse. Our only hope, our only confidence, the only firm promise that we have, is your mercy. 33. I used to be much more fascinated by the pleasures of sound than the pleasures of smell. I was enthralled by them, but you broke my bonds and set me free. I admit that I still find some enjoyment in the music of hymns that are alive with your praises when I hear them sung by well-trained melodious voices, but I do not enjoy it so much that I cannot tear myself away. I can leave it when I wish, but if I am not to turn a deaf ear to music, which is the setting for the words that give it life, I must allow it a position of some honor in my heart, and I find it difficult to assign it to its proper place, for sometimes I feel that I treat it with more honor than it deserves. I realize that when they are sung, these sacred words stir my mind to greater religious fervor and kindle in me a more ardent flame of piety than they would if they were not sung. And I also know that there are particular modes in song and in the voice corresponding to my various emotions, and able to stimulate them because of some mysterious relationship between the two. But I ought not allow my mind to be paralyzed by the gratification of my senses that often lead it astray, for the senses are not content to take second place. Simply because I allow them their due, as adjuncts to reason, they attempt to take precedence and forge ahead of it, with the result that I sometimes sin in this way, but am not aware of it until later. Sometimes, too, from over-anxiety to avoid this particular trap, I make the mistake of being too strict. When this happens, I have no wish but to exclude from my ears, and from the ears of the church as well, all the melody of those lovely chants to which the Psalms of David are habitually sung. And it seems safer to me to follow the precepts which I remember often having heard ascribed to Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, who used to oblige the lectors to recite the psalms with such slight modulation of the voice that they seemed to be speaking rather than chanting. But when I remember the tears that I shed on hearing the songs of the church in the early days, soon after I had recovered my faith, and when I realize that nowadays it is not the singing that moves me, but the meaning of the words when they are sung in a clear voice to the most appropriate tune, I again acknowledge the great value of this practice. So I waver between the danger that lies in gratifying the senses and the benefits which, as I know from experience, can accrue from singing. Without committing myself to an irrevocable opinion, I am inclined to approve of the custom of singing in church, in order that by indulging the ears, weaker spirits may be inspired with feelings of devotion. Yet when I find the singing itself more moving than the truth that it conveys, I confess that this is a grievous sin, and at those times I would prefer not to hear the singer. This, then, is my present state. Let those of my readers whose hearts are filled with charity, from which good actions spring, weep with me and weep for me. Those who feel no charity in themselves will not be moved by my words. But I beg you, O Lord my God, to look upon me and listen to me. Have pity on me and heal me, for you see that I have become a problem to myself, and this is the ailment from which I suffer. 34. Finally, I must confess how I am tempted through the eye. Let the ears of your church, the ears of my devout brothers in Christ, listen to my words, so that I may bring an end to my discussion of the body's temptations to pleasure, which still provoke me as I sigh, longing for the shelter of that home which heaven will give me. The eye delights in beautiful shapes of different sorts and bright and attractive colors. I would not have these things take possession of my soul. Let God possess it, He who made them all. He made them all very good, but it is He who is my God, not they. All day and every day while I am awake, there they are before my eyes. They allow me no respite, such as I am granted in moments of silence when there is no singing, and sometimes no sound at all to be heard. For light, the queen of colors, pervades all that I see. Wherever I am throughout the day, and by the ever-changing pattern of its rays, it entices me, even when I am occupied with something else and take no special note of it. It wins so firm a hold on me that, if I am suddenly deprived of it, I long to have it back, and if I am left for long without it, I grow dispirited. But the true light is the light that Tobias saw, when, though his eyes were blind, he taught his son the path he should follow in life, and himself led the way, charity guiding his steps so that he did not stray. It is the light that Isaac saw when the sight of his eyes was dimmed and clouded by old age, and it was granted to him not to bless his sons in full knowledge as to which was which, but to know them by blessing them. It is the light that Jacob saw when, though his eyes were blinded by old age, a light shone in his heart and cast its beams over the tribes of Israel yet to come, as he foresaw them in the persons of his son. It is the light that he saw when he laid his hands on his grandchildren, the sons of Joseph, not in the way that their father, who saw only the outward act, tried to make him do it, but mystically crossed in the way that he discerned by the light that shone within him. This is the true light. It is one alone, and all who see and love it are one. But in our life in the world, this earthly light of which I am speaking is a seasoning, sweet and tempting, but dangerous for those whose love for it is blind. Yet those who have learned to praise you for this as well as your other gifts, O God, maker of all things, sing a hymn of praise for it. They are not beguiled by it in their dreams. For myself, I wish to be as they are. I resist the allurements of the eye for fear that as I walk upon your path, my feet may be caught in a trap. Instead, I raise the eyes of my spirit to you, so that you may save my feet from the snare. Time and again you save them, for I fail to escape the trap. You never cease to free me, although again and again I find myself caught in the snares that are laid all about me. For you are the guardian of Israel, one who is never weary and never sleeps. By every kind of art and the skill of their hands, men make innumerable things, clothing, shoes, pottery, and other useful objects, besides pictures and various works that are the fruit of their imagination. They make them on a far more lavish scale than is required to satisfy their most modest needs or to express their devotion. And all these things are additional temptations to the eye, made by men who love the worldly things they make themselves, but forget their own maker and destroy what he made in them. But, O God, my glory, for these things I too offer you a hymn of thanksgiving. I make a sacrifice of praise to him who sanctifies me, for the beauty that flows through men's minds into their skillful hands comes from that beauty that is above their souls and for which my soul sighs all day and night. It is from the same supreme beauty that men who make things of beauty and love it in its outward forms derive the principle by which they judge it. But they do not accept the same principle to guide them in the use they make of it. Yet there it is. They do not see it. If only they could see it, they would not depart from it. They would preserve their strength for you, not squander it on luxuries that make them weary. Though I say this and see that it is true, my feet are still caught in the toils of this world's beauty. But you will free me, O Lord. I know that you will free me, for I ever keep your mercies in mind. I am caught and need your mercy, and by your mercy you will save me from the snare. Sometimes, if I have not fallen deep into the trap, I shall feel nothing when you rescue me. But at other times, when I am fast ensnared, I shall suffer the pain of it. 35. I must now speak of a different kind of temptation, more dangerous than these, because it's more complicated. For in addition to our bodily appetites that make us long to gratify all our senses and our pleasures, and lead to our ruin if we stay away from you by becoming their slaves, the mind is also subject to a certain propensity to use the sense of the body, not for self-indulgence of a physical kind, but for the satisfaction of its own inquisitiveness. This futile curiosity masquerades under the name of science and learning, and it derives from our thirst for knowledge, and sight is the principal sense by which knowledge is acquired. In the scriptures, it is called gratification of the eye. For although, correctly speaking, to see is the proper function of the eyes, we use the word of the other senses, too, when we employ them to acquire knowledge. We don't say, hear how it glows, or smell how bright it is, or taste how it shines, or feel how it glitters, because these are all things which we say that we see. Yet we not only say, see how it shines, when we are speaking of something that only the eyes can perceive, but we also say, see how loud it is, see how it smells, see how it tastes, and see how hard it is. So, as I said, sense experience in general is called the lust of the eye because, although the function of sight belongs primarily to the eyes, we apply it to the other organs of sense as well, by analogy, when they are used to discover any item of knowledge. We can easily distinguish between the motives of pleasure and curiosity. When the senses demand pleasure, they look for objects of visual beauty, harmonious sounds, fragrant perfumes, and things that are pleasant to the taste or soft to the touch. But when their motive is curiosity, they may look for just the reverse of these things, simply to put it to the proof, not for the sake of an unpleasant experience, but for a relish for investigation and discovery. What pleasure can there be in the sight of a mangled corpse that can only horrify? Yet people will flock to see one lying on the ground simply for the sensation of sorrow and horror that it gives them. They are even afraid that it may bring them nightmares, as though it were something that they had been forced to look at while they were awake, or something to which they had been attracted by rumors of its beauty. The same is true of the other senses, although it would be tedious to give further examples. It is to satisfy this unhealthy curiosity that freaks and prodigies are put on show in the theater. And for some reason, men are led to investigate the secrets of nature that are irrelevant to our lives, although such knowledge is of no value to them, and they wish to gain it merely for the sake of knowing. It is curiosity, too, that causes men to turn to sorcery in the effort to obtain knowledge for the same perverted purpose. And it even invades our religion, for we put God to the test when we demand signs and wonders from him, not in the hope of salvation, but simply for the love of experience. In this immense forest, so full of snares and dangers, I have pared away many sins and thrust them from my heart, for you have given me the grace to do this, O God, my Savior. But as long as my daily life has passed in the midst of the clamor raised by so many temptations of this sort, when can I presume to say nothing of this kind can hold my attention or tempt me into idle speculation? It is true that the theater no longer attracts me. The study of astrology does not interest me. I have never dealt in necromancy, and I detest all sacrilegious rites. But how often has not the enemy used his wiles upon me to suggest that I should ask for some sign from you, O Lord my God, to whom I owe my humble, undivided service. I beseech you, by Christ our King and by Jerusalem the chaste, our homeland, that just as I now withhold my consent from these suggestions, I may always continue to ward them off and keep them still farther from me. When I pray to you for the salvation of another, the purpose and intention of my prayer is far different. For you do what you will, and you grant me, as you always will, the grace to follow you gladly. Yet, who can tell how many times each day our curiosity is tempted by the most trivial and insignificant matters? Who can tell how often we give way? So often it happens that when others tell foolish tales, at first we bear with them for fear of offending the weak, and then, little by little, we begin to listen willingly. I no longer go to watch a dog chasing a hare at the games in the circus. But if I should happen to see the same thing in the country as I pass by, the chase might easily hold my attention and distract me from whatever serious thoughts occupied my mind. It might not actually compel me to turn my horse from the path, but such would be the inclination of my heart, unless you made me realize my weakness and quickly reminded me either to turn my eyes from the sight and raise my thoughts to you in contemplation, or to despise it utterly and continue on my way. What excuse can I make for myself when often, as I sit at home, I cannot turn my eyes from the sight of a lizard catching flies, or a spider entangling them as they fly into her web? Does it make any difference that these are only small animals? It is true that the sight of them inspires me to praise you for the wonders of your creation, and the order in which you have disposed all things. But I am not intent upon your praises when I first begin to watch. It is one thing to rise quickly from a fall, another not to fall at all. My life is full of such faults, and my only hope is in your boundless mercy. For when our hearts become repositories piled high with such worthless stock as this, it is the cause of interruption and distraction from our prayers. And although in your presence the voices of our hearts are raised to your ear, all kinds of trivial thoughts break in and cut us off from the great act of prayer. 36. Must I not consider this too as one of the faults that I ought to despise? Can anything restore me to hope except your mercy? That you are merciful, I know, for you have begun to change me. You know how great a change you have worked in me, for first of all you have cured me of the desire to assert my claim to liberty, so that you may also pardon me all my sins, heal all my mortal ills, rescue my life from deadly peril, crown me with the blessings of your mercy, and content all my desire for good. You know how great a change you have worked in me, for you have curbed my pride by teaching me to fear you, and you have tamed my neck to your yoke. And now I bear your yoke. I find its burden light, for this was your promise, and you have kept your word. In truth, though I did not know it, it was light even in the days when I was afraid to bend my neck to it. But, O Lord, you who alone rule without pride, since you are the only true Lord, and no other Lord rules over you, there is a third kind of temptation that I fear, and it has not passed from me. Can it ever pass from me in all this life? It is a desire to be feared or loved by other men, simply for the pleasure that it gives me, though in such pleasure there is no true joy. It means only a life of misery and despicable vainglory. It is for this reason more than any other that men neither love you nor fear you in the purity of heart. It is for this reason that you thwart the proud and keep your grace for the humble. This is why, with a voice of thunder, you condemn the ambitions of the world, so that the very foundations of the hills quail and quake. This is why the enemy of our true happiness persists in his attacks upon me, for he knows that when men hold certain offices in human society, it is necessary that they should be loved and feared by other men. He sets his traps about me, baiting them with tributes and applause, in the hope that in my eagerness to listen I may be caught off my guard. He wants me to divorce my joy from the truth and place it in man's duplicity. He wants me to enjoy being loved and feared by others, not for your sake, but in your place, so that in this way he may make me like himself and keep me to share with him, not the true fellowship of charity, but the bonds of common punishment. For he determined to set his throne in the north, where chilled and benighted men might serve him as he imitates you in his perverse, distorted way. But we, O Lord, are your little flock. Keep us as your own. Spread your wings and let us shelter beneath them. Let us glory in you alone. If you are loved or feared by others, let it be for your sake. No man who seeks the praise of other men can be defended by men when you call him to account. Men cannot save him when you condemn. But it happens also not that praise is given to the man who is proud of his wicked end achieved, or that the evildoer wins applause, but that a man is praised for some gift that you have given him. And if he takes greater joy in the praise which he receives than in the possession of the gift for which men praise him, then the price he pays for their applause is the loss of your favor, and he, the receiver of praise, is worse off than the giver. For the one finds pleasure in God's gift in man, while the other finds less pleasure in God's gift than in the gift of men themselves. 37. Day after day, without ceasing, these temptations put us to the test, O Lord. The human tongue is a furnace in which the temper of our souls is daily tried. And in this matter, too, you command us to be continent. Give me the grace to do as you command, and command me to do what you will. You know how I have cried to you from the depths of my heart, how I have wept floods of tears because of this difficulty. For I cannot easily deduce how far I am cured of this disease, and I have great fear of offending you unaware by sins to which I am blind, though to your eyes they are manifest. In other kinds of temptation I have some means of examining myself, but in this I have almost none. For I can see what progress I have made in the ability to restrain my mind from giving in to sensual pleasures or idle curiosity. It becomes plain when I do without these things, either voluntarily or for lack of the occasion, because I then ask myself how much or how little it troubles me to be without them. The same is true of wealth, which men grasp because they want means of satisfying one or another of these three kinds of temptation, or perhaps two, or even all three of them. If the soul, when it has riches, cannot tell whether it despises them, it can put itself to the proof by discarding of them. But if we are to do without praise in order to test our powers, are we to live such outrageously wicked and abandoned lives that all who know us will detest us? Is it possible to imagine a more insane proposal than this? If praise is normally associated with a good life and good works, and rightly so, we ought neither to cease living good lives nor to abandon the rightful consequences. But I cannot tell whether or not I have the forbearance to do without anything, unless it is taken away from me. What then is my attitude to temptation of this kind? What am I to confess to you, O Lord? I can only say I am gratified by praise, but less by praise than by the truth. For if I were asked whether I would prefer to be commended by all my fellow men for wild delusions and errors on all counts, or to be stigmatized by them for constancy and assurance in the truth, it is clear which I would choose. But I wish that words of praise from other men did not increase the joy I feel for any good qualities that I have. Yet I confess that it does increase my joy. What is more, their censure detracts from it. And when I am worried by this wretched failing, an excuse occurs to me. Though how good an excuse it is, only you know, O God. It leaves me in doubt. For you have commanded us not only to be continent, but also to be just. That is, to withhold our love from certain things and bestow it on others. You want us not only to love you, but also to love our neighbor. For this reason, I tell myself that when I am gratified by the praise of a man who well understands what it is that he praises, the true reason for my pleasure is that my neighbor has made good progress and shows promise for the future. Similarly, when I hear him cast a slur upon something that he doesn't understand, or something which in fact is good, I am sorry that he should have this failing. I am sometimes sorry, too, to hear my own praises, either when others commend me for qualities that I am not glad to possess, or when they value in me, more highly than their due, qualities that may be good, but are of little importance. But here again I cannot tell whether this feeling comes from reluctance to allow the man who praises me to disagree with me about my own qualities, not because I am concerned for his welfare, but because the good qualities that please me in myself please me still more when they please others as well. For in a certain sense, it is no compliment to me when my own opinion of myself is not upheld. In other words, either when qualities that displease me are commended, or when those that please me least are most applauded. Am I not right, then, to say that I am in doubt about this problem? My God, in the light of your truth, I see that if my feelings are stirred by praise that I receive, it should not be for my own sake, but for the good of my neighbor. But whether this is so with me, I do not know, for in this matter I know less about myself than I know of you. I beg you, my God, to reveal me to my own eyes, so that I may confess to my brothers in Christ what wounds I find in myself, for they will pray for me. Let me examine myself again, more closely. If it is the good of my neighbor that touches my heart when I hear my own praises, why am I less aggrieved when blame is unjustly laid at another's door than when it is laid at mine? Why do insults sting me more when they are offered to me than when I hear them offered to others with equal injustice? Can I plead ignorance in this case too? Or is the truth of the matter that I deceive myself, and that in heart and tongue alike I am guilty of falsehood in your presence? O Lord, keep such folly far from me, for fear that my lips should sin, sleeking my head with the oil of their flattery. 38. I am poor and needy, and I am better only when in sorrow of heart I detest myself and seek your mercy, until what is faulty in me is repaired and made whole, and finally I come to that state of peace that the eye of the proud cannot see. Yet in what others say about us, and in what they know of our deeds, there is great danger of temptation. For our love of praise leads us to court the good opinion of others, and hoard it for personal gratification. And even when I reproach myself for it, the love of praise tempts me. There is temptation in the very process of self-reproach, for often, by priding himself on his contempt for vainglory, a man is guilty of even emptier pride. And for this reason his contempt of vainglory is an empty boast, because he cannot really hold it in contempt as long as he prides himself in doing it. 39. Deep in our inner selves there is another evil, the outcome of the same kind of temptation. This is self-complacency, the vanity of those who are pleased with themselves, although they either fail to please others or have no wish to do so, and even actively displease them. But though they are pleasing to themselves, they are gravely displeasing to you, because they congratulate themselves not only upon qualities that are not good, as though they were good, but also upon good qualities received from you, as though they were their own gifts to themselves, or else they recognize them as yours but claim them for their own merits, or again they know that they have received them by your grace alone, but still they grudge your grace to others and will not rejoice in it with them. You see how my heart trembles and strains in the midst of all these perils, and others of a like kind? It is not as though I do not suffer wounds, but I feel rather that you heal them over and over again. 40. You have walked everywhere at my side, O Truth, teaching me what to seek and what to avoid. Whenever I laid before you the things that I was able to see in this world below, and asked you to counsel me. As far as my senses enabled me to do, I surveyed the world about me and explored both the life that my body has from me and the senses themselves. Next, I probed the depths of my memory, so vast in its ramifications and filled in so wonderful a way with riches beyond number. I scrutinized all these things and stood back in awe, for without you I could see none of them, and I found that none of them was you. Nor was I myself the truth, I who found them, I who explored them all and tried to distinguish and appraise each according to its worth. Some of them were conveyed to me by means of my physical senses, and I subjected them to question. Others, which closely concerned my own self, I encountered in my feelings. I enumerated the various means by which these messages were brought to me and distinguished between them. And in the great treasury of my memory, there were yet other things that I examined. Some of them I returned to the keeping of my memory, others I picked out for study. But when I was doing all this, I was not myself the truth. That is, the power by which I did it was not the truth. For you, the truth, are the unfailing light from which I sought counsel upon all these things, asking whether they were, what they were, and how they were to be valued. But I heard you teaching me, and I heard the commands you gave. Often I do this. I find pleasure in it, and whenever I can relax from my necessary duties, I take refuge in this pleasure. But in all the regions where I thread my way, seeking your guidance, only in you do I find a safe haven for my mind, a gathering place for my scattered parts, where no portion of me can depart from you. And sometimes you allow me to experience a feeling quite unlike my normal state, an inward sense of delight that, if it were to reach perfection in me, would be something not encountered in this life, though what it is I cannot tell. But my heavy burden of distress drags me down to the earth. Again, I become a prey to my habits that hold me fast. My tears flow, but I am still held fast. Such is the price we pay for the burden of custom. In this state, I am fit to stay, unwilling though I am. In that other state where I wish to stay, I am not fit to be. I have double cause for sorrow. 41. I have now considered the sorry state to which my sins have brought me, according to the three different forms that temptation may take, and I have invoked your helping hand to save me. For in my wounded heart I saw your splendor, and it dazzled me, and I asked, who can come close to such glory? Your watchful care has lost sight of me. You are the truth that presides over all things, but in my selfish longing I did not wish to lose you. Together with you I wanted to possess a lie, much as a man will not utter so glaring a falsehood that it blinds his own eyes to the truth. And in this way I lost you, because you do not deign to be possessed together with a lie. 42. Whom could I find to reconcile me to you? Should I have looked for the help of the angels? But if I had sought their help, what prayers should I have uttered? What rites should I have used? Many men, so I have heard, for lack of strength to return to you by themselves, have tried to do so by this means. But they ended by craving for strange visions, and their only reward was delusion. For they tried to find you in all the conceit and arrogance of their learning. They thrust out their chests in pride, when they should have beaten their breasts in mourning. And because they resembled them at heart, they attracted to their side the fallen angels, the princes of the lower air, their companions and associates in pride. But these allies tricked them, using magic craft, for while they sought a mediator who would cleanse them of their impurities, it was no mediator they found. It was the devil, passing for an angel of light, and it was a potent lure for their proud flesh that he was not a creature of flesh and blood, for they were mortal men and sinners. But you, O Lord, to whom they wanted to be reconciled, are immortal and without sin. But a mediator between God and man must have something in common with God and something in common with man. But if in both these points he were like men, he would be far from God. And if in both of them he were like God, he would be far from men. In neither case could he be a mediator. But since, by the hidden pronouncements of your justice, you have given the devil license to make a mockery of pride, he poses as a mediator. For in one point he is like man, he is sinful, and in the other he pretends to be like God, because he is not clothed with a mortal body of flesh and blood. He tries to represent himself as immortal. But since the wages for sin are death, in common with men he has this reason to be condemned to die. 43. But there is a true mediator, whom in your secret mercy you have shown to men. You have sent him so that by his example they too might learn humility. He is the mediator between God and men, Jesus Christ, who is a man. And he appeared on earth between men, who are sinful and mortal, and God, who is immortal and just. Like men, he was mortal. Like God, he was just. And because the reward of the just is life and peace, he came so that by his own justness, which is his in union with God, he might make null the death of the wicked whom he justified, by choosing to share their death. He was made known to holy men in ancient times, so that they might be saved through faith in his passion to come, just as we are saved through faith in the passion he suffered long ago. For as man he is our mediator, but as the word of God he is not an intermediary between God and man, because he is equal with God, and God with God, and together with him one God. How great was your love for us, good Father! For you did not even spare your own Son, but gave him up to save us sinners. How great was your love for us when it was for us that Christ, who did not see in the rank of Godhead a prize to be coveted, accepted an obedience that brought him to death, death on a cross. He alone was free among the dead, for he was free to lay down his life and free to take it up again. He was for us both victor and victim in your sight, and it was because he was the victim that he was also the victor. In your sight, he was for us both priest and sacrifice, and it was because he was the sacrifice that he was also the priest. By being your son, yet serving you, he freed us from servitude and made us your sons. Rightly do I place in him my firm hope that you will cure all my ills through him who sits at your right hand and pleads for us. Otherwise I should despair. For my ills are many and great indeed. But your medicine is greater still. We might have thought that your word was far distant from union with man, so that we might have despaired of ourselves, if he had not been made flesh and come to dwell among us. Terrified by my sins and the dead weight of my misery, I had turned my problems over in my mind, and was half determined to seek refuge in the desert. But you forbade me to do this, and gave me strength by saying, Christ died for us all, so that being alive should no longer mean living with our own life, but with his life who died for us. Lord, I cast all my troubles on you, and from now on I shall contemplate the wonders of your law. You know how weak I am, and how inadequate is my knowledge. Teach me and heal my frailty. Your only Son, in whom the whole treasury of wisdom and knowledge is stored up, has redeemed me with his blood. Save me from the scorn of my enemies, for the price of my redemption is always in my thoughts. I eat it and drink it and minister it to others. And as one of the poor, I long to be filled with it, to be one of those who eat and have their fill. And those who look for the Lord will cry out in praise of him. End of Book 10.